I had Asherman syndrome.
What's that?
So Asherman syndrome is when the uterine walls, they have adhesions and they are stuck. So obviously there's no possibility for you to fall pregnant. There's not going to be implantation on the uterus because it is stuck together. Because Australia has a very good setup for IVF, yeah. A lot of that is covered by the government.
Okay.
So we did 5 rounds. At the end, we had a total of 5 embryos. And they were all over the place, really, like all over Australia. So then it's like, okay, well, surrogacy. And in Australia, it's legal, but it is altruistic, which it can happen if you have sisters or cousins or mothers that would be willing to do. But because we are both foreigners, we're now Australians, but our families are in Mexico or in Ireland, that was not a road that we really could look into. We started looking into many countries. Canada is another one that you can actually do it legally. It's also altruistic. In the US, you can do it, but you need to sell your kidney to be able to do it. Because it's just so expensive, and we were not in the position to actually like paying that amount of money. Mexico was another one. Colombia was another one. Ukraine was the other one. And Ukraine is the only place in the world where it's fully legal and is fully regulated for all parties.
We just had a pretty simple chat going, look, are we prepared to go into like war zone? Kyiv is fine, it's not a war zone, but like the country is at war.
Mm.
Are we prepared to go there if we're lucky enough to have a baby? And instantly the two of us just said yes.
Welcome to my podcast, The Laura Dowling Experience. Many of you will know me from my Instagram page at Fabulous Pharmacist, where I love to shine a light on topics that people normally shy away from. Today I spoke with my friends Paul and Martha. Paul and Martha went through a surrogacy journey during the war in Ukraine with a Ukrainian surrogate mother. They tell their story today. As long and arduous as it was, it resulted in the birth of their beautiful baby girl. The Laura Dowling Experience is brought to you today by Fabu Or and Or Relax. Fabu Or and Or Relax is my unique blend of botanicals with magnesium and B vitamins. I formulated this blend after years of listening to people coming in and out of the pharmacy looking for something natural to help with stress and to help with sleep. I have blended ashwagandha, L-theanine from green tea, chamomile and melissa together. These botanicals have been used in traditional Ayurvedic, Indian and Eastern medicine for thousands of years to calm the nervous system, reduce stress and promote a more restorative and restful sleep. Vitamin B5 supports mental performance, B12 and B3 contribute to normal psychological function and magnesium reduces tiredness and fatigue. Take one capsule twice a day to reduce stress and promote calm throughout the day, or take 2 at night for a more restful and restorative sleep. Check out fabiwellness.com for the most amazing reviews available on fabiwellness.com and in pharmacies and health food stores nationwide. Enjoy the show. Welcome, Paul and Martha, to the Laura Dowling Experience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is brilliant to have you here. I have you here today to talk about your surrogacy journey. The who, the what, the where, the when, the why. Because it's been a long road for you, hasn't it?
It has. It's been now 6 years, 7 years.
Okay. And you now have your beautiful little baby.
Yeah, we do.
How old is she now?
She's about a month, four weeks.
Okay. And she's gorgeous with red hair, just like her daddy.
Yes, her mommy's very happy about that.
So, it's unbelievable. When you sent me the picture of her, I was literally like, Paul, that is a mini Paul. And just so everyone knows, Paul and I, we go back a long time. Paul is my younger brother's very good friend and lived down the road from us for years. So it is just an absolute pleasure to have him and his wife here today. So Martha, do you want to start from the start as to what brought you along the surrogacy route, why it had to happen for you and why this was the way you had to have your baby?
Yeah. So as any new couple, we obviously try to get pregnant and we were trying for 6 months and nothing was happening and we were not really that young anymore. So we knew that we had to look for some fertility specialists. So we did go and they found out that I had Asherman syndrome.
What's that?
So Asherman syndrome is when the uterine walls are stuck to each other. They have adhesions and they are stuck. So obviously there's no possibility for you to fall pregnant. There's not going to be implantation on the uterus because it is stuck together.
And is this a common?
It's not a common thing. I did have a myomectomy in 2012. And the scarring of that operation led to Usherman syndrome, which I had no idea I had.
Okay. And the myomectomy, why did you have to have that?
Because I had multiple cysts and fibroids.
Okay.
So, I had to have a very invasive surgery. It was like having a C-section pretty much. Okay. And they removed almost a kilo of fibroids. So it was very, very invasive on my uterus. And,
Was back in 2012. How old were you then?
I was 32.
Okay. And can I ask you, had you suffered from heavy periods all your life, etc.?
No. Okay. That's the funniest thing, that I had no symptoms whatsoever about having fibroids.
Okay.
So it was not until I actually got a cold. I went to my GP and he's like, let me do a full checkup on you. And he's like, look, your cold's going to go away, but I noticed a little lump on your stomach, so I want you to get that checked. So I did, and they found out that there was just not one, but many, many fibroids, the biggest one the size of my fist. And within 2 weeks, I actually had to have surgery because there were just too many.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if you hadn't have had those removed, you wouldn't have got that syndrome, though, would you?
Well, no, but then I would have not been able to fall pregnant either, because it was just no space in the uterus because of the amount of fibroids that I had.
Okay, okay.
So I remember at the time when having the surgery, the doctor saying, look, I did everything I could so that I could save your uterus.
Okay.
So we're going to work together for you when you decide down the line to become a mother.
Okay.
To make that happening.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. So how was it recovering from that surgery then?
It took me about 2 months to really recover. It was like a C-section pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, two full months. But at the time I did not have a partner or anything, so I did not thought of any more than they're removed. And everything's been fixed and, you know, have a happy normal life. Little did I know.
And where did you have this surgery? Because obviously, just for anyone listening on audio, they'll notice that you have a lovely accent. So where are you from?
I'm from Mexico City.
Okay. And did you have the surgery there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I was still living in Mexico City at the time.
Okay. So let's talk about how you found out that you would need to go about the surrogacies.
Yeah. So then a year after, when we found out that we were not falling pregnant, we found the Usherman syndrome situation. So I had like about 12 surgeries to try to open the uterus. So within that period, we had 2 miscarriages and we started IVF as well. So within IVF, because of my age, I was unable to get as many eggs, but we had a few. The last time that
were you when you were trying for the IVF?
38, 39.
Okay. Yeah, for the first time.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the last round of IVF, my doctor, we changed many times from many doctors because we were not getting a single egg in many of the rounds.
Were you doing all the things they say to do? Like, was your life almost on hold for these egg retrievals? Because it's a excruciating, grueling process, isn't it, in terms of diet, lifestyle, exercise, but then also exercise. What it does to your body.
Yeah, totally.
The injections.
Everything.
Yeah, poor thing. So many injections. So.
Did you have to inject her?
No.
She did herself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the very last time our doctor, she's like, I won't do the transfer. Not now and not ever. You can't. Because before they do the transfer, they do a scan as well to see the lining of the uterus and just the state. You know, because they want to do a successful transfer. They really want to create a baby. And they noticed that it was just not a hospitable place for an embryo.
The fibroids had returned. There was more, like from all the hysteroscopy procedures that she'd had, like the human body, like does what it does best. Like they cut the adhesions, but then they heal. Yeah. Some of them heal back together and constant. So we needed many of them to do it, but the lining never really returned to a sufficient kind of thickness. They kept saying geriatric pregnancy. It was the first time we'd ever heard of that. And we're like, what age do you think we are? But it's just a term for anything over 35. Mm-hmm. And then just the lining didn't get thick enough. And they're like, look, it's really high risk pregnancy. It will always be for you. And the lining wasn't thick enough. Then the fibroids had returned. And she goes, look, it could be just like wasted embryos potentially if we do it.
And life-threatening as well for me.
But yeah, they thought it was risky.
Yeah. So she's, I'm not going to do it. Which we were very glad that she was just upfront with us and that we, you know, like to set the right expectation of what we're, I mean, where were we standing? Okay. So she did say, you can look after surrogacy and I'll help you all the way for you guys, like whatever you need. Like you, she extended a letter saying the reasons why we were not able to have our own kids and that surrogacy was the only way. Or adoption. But in Australia, adoption is another story completely.
It's very difficult to adopt.
It's very difficult. Yeah.
It's the same in Ireland. It's
and,
very difficult.
And just even like the initial process, we looked at the adoption was like, obviously they need to obviously scrutinize like the background, etc. But there was a very kind of like negative attitude from them towards us. And mm-hmm. I think Martha has, and they were always screening, and Martha, like in two initial, there's phone calls. Martha said, like, we have been trying for a baby, and that's what we're like, we're looking to adoption to see it. And then another phone call, because she just said the word baby, and straight away they go, you're not ready for this. Come back to us in a year because you said baby, pretty much. It was like very off putting. So we were like, not going down this road.
And what was wrong with her saying baby?
Because they said they thought that she, like, emotionally, we weren't over the diagnosis that we couldn't hold a baby, etc. And they just said, you're not mentally ready for this and stuff like that. And you're not in adoption, you generally will never get a baby. And I don't think you're going to accept that. And they just were pretty ruthless, like from the start. So we were just put off from that process. And
okay. And
then, yeah, just decided to check out surrogacy and see what happens. And,
And did IVF cost you a lot of money?
Yes and no. Just because Australia has a very good set up for IVF.
Yeah.
So a lot of that is covered by the government.
Okay.
But we did so many rounds that, definitely.
How many rounds did you do?
A lot. Polly has more count on that.
I think we did about 5 in total. Oh, now, goodness. Like Martha was saying, the Australian healthcare system is quite well set up for it. So there's different levels of clinics. There's some. So in Australia, there's a free healthcare, like Medicare. And there are some IVF clinics that do, it's bulk billed, so it's actually doesn't cost you any money out of your pocket. Now, these are mightn't have as much or specialized facilities to do things. We wanted to potentially do like chromosome testing, etc., because of the age of the eggs. That required a private clinic, and there were some that are in conjunction with universities, and it might be a little bit of money. And then the final one, we went to a private clinic that was expensive, but that Medicare system from the government rebates you about half the cost of it, which is fantastic, because I think I was just reading in the Irish Times here recently, they're going to maybe cover one round and you have to be under a certain BMI and under a certain age and all that stuff, and they seem very restrictive, where in Australia it's like they're very supportive of it. So so that was a tremendous help, like financially, like, to do that. So.
Yeah, so we did 5 rounds. And at the end, we had a total of 5 embryos.
So at the very end of those 5 rounds, you had 5 embryos left over? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and they were all over the place, really, like all over Australia.
Yeah, so we had 5 embryos from 3 different clinics, actually.
Yeah.
And then, so then we needed to try and consolidate them into one place. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
No matter what it took, we were going to do it. If this didn't work, then we try with another and then with another. But then it's like, okay, well, surrogacy. Right. In Australia, let's look into it. And in Australia, it's legal.
It is legal.
It is legal.
Okay.
You can do it, but it is altruistic. So that means that someone needs to offer you being your surrogate. You cannot go and ask and say, hey, would you be my surrogate, please? You know, you can't.
And obviously with altruistic, money can't exchange hands.
You can't. Like, you can cover all the cost for the person if they lose their job, and if you have to pay for daycare because they have to go to the doctor, all the medical expenses, all of that, you obviously can cover and you should cover. But yeah, you can obviously not exchange any financial support for them because it is altruistic. They're doing it for the good of their hearts.
Okay.
Which it can happen if you have sisters or cousins or mothers that, you know, would be willing to do. But because we are both foreigners, we're now Australians, but our families are in Mexico or in Ireland, that was not a road that we really could look into because our families is just not there. And you can join these Facebook groups and start looking for some angel that will do it out of the goal of their heart. But it's like the amount of people doing surrogacy in Australia and the few little group of people or surrogates that will be willing to do it, and it's just the chances of that happening were next to zero.
Okay.
Okay, so let's look into going overseas and doing it. So first of all, we just wanted to do it the right way. We didn't want to go and do anything illegal or anything. So based on that, we start looking into many countries. Canada is another one that is that you can actually do it legally. It's also altruistic. The US, you can do it, but you need to sell your kidney to be able to do it. Because it's just so expensive, and we were not in the position to actually, you know, like paying that amount of money. Mexico was another one. Colombia was another one. Ukraine was the other one. Okay. So in Mexico, we did look into it because it was like the obvious choice. Me being Mexican, it would have been much easier for me and my family to just hold it there. But it was not 100% legal. It's only legal in a few states. And we both parents have to be Mexican. And we're
gonna just dyed Paul's hair now.
Just grow a mustache and put a sombrero on, but didn't really fit in. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were just not feeling comfortable with the whole. It's not legal, but it's not illegal. Mm. So we'll figure out a way. And it was really expensive with no guarantees, which obviously no one gives you a guarantee. It's science and you know, it's trial and error. But we felt that it was just not the right call. We didn't have very good feedback from a lot of people that had actually done it in Canada. And just articles of surrogacy agencies, they were really bad. Even doctors that we've spoken, they were just saying, look, in Canada, it's just...
It's like they say it's altruistic in everything, only in name. But it's under the hood, it's very kind of commercialized and... Not to denigrate the whole industry there, but a lot of the feedback we got is that people are like very coached to obtain the maximum amount of reimbursement from people. And there's some clinics that are not very thorough on medical checks for surrogate mothers. So there should be a lot of like blood and alcohol, drugs, mental health checks and stuff that people are like in the right place physically and mentally and emotionally to be able to do this. Some clinics are very loose on what they would count as permissible, and that just didn't really fill us with a lot of confidence. And we had met a friend actually who they were like very deep into the process and their baby was due in 3 months, but they said they wouldn't recommend. They just said they were very off-putted by it and would never do it there again. So that turned us off the idea. And then
I kept researching, and Ukraine is the only place in the world where it's fully legal and is fully regulated for all parties. So for the surrogate mother, for us, and for the agency that actually makes this possible. Okay. But it was the Ukraine, something that was very foreign to us. Like we barely knew anything about Ukraine at that point. And at this point, there was no war. So when we were looking into doing this was 2000...
Later, like second half of 2021, really.
2021, yeah. But it was COVID time as well. But again, it's like, okay, what agency do you choose and why? So again, doing more research, I found this lady in Argentina that she had actually done a process in the Ukraine. And so I got in touch with her and just asked her everything, like how much it cost, how was it to be in the Ukraine, the language barrier. She had two of her sons in there. And at the end, she's like, no, look, it's fully legal. It's really well regulated. They look really well after the mothers. I have both my kids there. So, like, I would do it again. I'm like, well, if you don't mind me asking, which agency are you doing it with? So she did tell me the name, which was one of the shortlisted agencies that we had it with. So
is there hundreds of these agencies?
Yeah, there's many.
A lot. Yeah, there's a lot. And I think even still, like in the groups that we're in, we hear of new ones every day that we'd never heard of before.
Yeah.
But again, when you're researching this from Australia, going, like looking up a digital agency, you're like, it's like you Google anything. They're like, how do I know this is actually a legit operation? You don't. Like, and you're kind of worried going, especially totally foreign country to us. How do we know what's legit and what's not? And it was really great that Martha found that Argentinian lady because we just followed, you could see all her Instagram stories, whole journey, everything she'd done and pros and cons, everything great about the city, etc. But at no point she never mentions the agency that she went with. And it was just only at the end when we asked her and she told us a name that gave us like additional independent kind of verification of one of the ones that we thought sounded good to us. So,
okay.
So that was great. And she's really not really helpful.
Yeah.
Okay.
And one of the reasons that we actually had shortlisted is that Because, I mean, we are paying for this. It is regulated. You know, we all understand that we are going to pay for this. The payments themselves were really aligned to the pregnancy, which gives you reassurance that you're not throwing your money to someone upfront expecting for something to happen.
And how does the payment system work then?
Well, you know, is it best,
I think when you sign, you pay about a third of the price.
Okay.
And then at a confirmation of pregnancy, at the 12-week mark, then there's a next payment, milestone payment, and then a 7 months, another payment. And then the last milestone payment is when you obtain all the birth certificate, all the paperwork and everything, and you have everything you need to apply for citizenship in your own country to go. So that was just a lot more kind of normalized, I think, for us, because like even for example the one in Mexico, you needed to pay about like 80% or 90% upfront before there was even like an embryo transfer. And if it didn't work, then it doesn't work. But it was just a hell of a lot of money to pay upfront. So this one just suited us a lot better.
Can I ask you how much it was?
The program cost about 30 at the time. It cost us about 36,000 euro.
That's the purely alone. It wasn't for the embryos that you'd already.
This is just for the surrogacy process. So there was like obviously all the IVF costs before that, the shipment of the embryos from Australia to Ukraine. That's a lot of money. That's like probably we paid in Australian dollars is about just over 5,000 Australian dollars. So about, I think it's about 3,700 euro. Yeah. But needed somebody to like physically bring them, because there's like two options. You can put them in the cargo, or somebody can like
hand carry
kind of like that movie, the hand briefcase in the hand, like locked to the hand and bring it on the plane. And that's what we preferred. And it was actually cheaper to do that. But we just felt that was not as subject to as many x-rays, scans, throwing around with the baggage handlers, all that kind of stuff.
And what did you transfer it in?
In a drawer full of liquid nitrogen.
In a drawer full of liquid nitrogen, okay. Yeah. And did you have the option to transfer it yourself if you'd wanted to bring it yourself?
We couldn't, but we wouldn't have that technical equipment to do it. And I don't want to be messing around with liquid nitrogen because I'm not a scientist.
Okay, so there's that then. So you got all of your five embryos that were all over Australia. So,
yeah, we finally put them all together in Australia.
Okay.
But then at this point in time, it's 2021 and Australian borders are closed. So no one can get in or out.
Only Australian citizens were allowed into the country.
So you're engaging with this company that is going to handle your embryos. They have to have an Australian citizen working with them to be able to transfer the embryos to Ukraine. So in 2021, December, Australia finally opened its borders and there was an Australian citizen that was able to hand carry them and bring them to Ukraine.
Okay.
So that's where it started, like, okay, well, COVID was in the middle of the mix. And yeah, that started there. But also the other reason I wanted to say that why we chose these agencies as well, that they really looked after the surrogate mothers. And for us, that was really important. Like that they get paid well and they really screen them properly, that they have all the medical support for them, like all the pregnancy support for them. We had our own coordinator that will handle every single thing for us as intended parents, but then she will have her own coordinator that she will manage all her medical appointments, all her like maternity necessities, and that we really wanted her to be really well looked after.
Of course.
Yeah.
So how was she linked to you guys? How did that process happen?
Yeah, so when I suppose you're on like the waiting list. So people have some countries and actually if you're going to engage in surrogacy, the surrogate mother has to not be married and certain things like that. So Australia, it didn't have anything like that, but some countries do, whereas some people may want to try for twins, etc. So there's different kind of like waiting lists per se for surrogacy.
Why would a surrogate mother not have to be married?
Just the regulation of, I think in the UK, they needed not to be married. And certain other countries, the surrogate mother couldn't be married.
And do we know the reason why?
I think here, because there's different things about parentage orders and stuff like that. I think if they're married, it creates complications for that, is my very basic understanding, but I'm not 100% sure.
As in the person that she's married to could potentially be the father of the child.
Correct, so, yeah. I think it's just additional complications, I think, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so 2 months after our embryos arrived in Kyiv, the Russians rolled into Ukraine, which we just were watching and we just couldn't believe.
Yeah.
And we were like, okay, everything's done.
Yeah. We thought that day, we were watching the news and I was like, they're gone. Let's just call the fertility specialist again and just get more embryos done. So we did another round and we created another couple of embryos and we just...
We're like, all right, we're back to the drawing board. Because we just thought the whole place would be leveled and all our embryos that we'd worked for would be destroyed.
Yeah. We actually got an email from the agency that due to unforeseen situations, they force majeure applied and...
The contracts are kind
contract
of...
Contract is null and void.
Potentially could be null and void, etc.
And did those embryos go missing? Or
so those embryos have a little bit of a story as well. So when the Russians started invading, Ukraine implemented martial law. So any, what they call them, like military age male, 18 to 60, is not allowed to leave the country. And but the head embryologist in the clinic where our embryos were was not a Ukrainian citizen. He was from somewhere else in Europe. So he, thankfully, he was like, obviously he thought this city may get absolutely wiped out. Took it upon himself with a bunch of other people that like coordinated and transported all of the embryos to Slovakia.
17,000 embryos.
Like a ton.
Yours and everyone
and
else's.
A lot of other people's, yeah. Moved them to like, so they wouldn't get an eye, like wiped out, and moved them to a clinic in Slovakia where they were safe and stored for probably about 6 months, really. And we were just like, we heard this and we were like, this guy's like,
our hero.
Guardian angel, like, because he just, like, well, I'm not going to let
him. Embryologist?
Yeah, he's a head of embryologist.
So he's like, I'm not letting these guys die.
Yeah, exactly. Like. So he just took it upon himself to do that and saves them for us and for countless other people as well.
They're crying.
Yeah. So these embryos have been shipped around Australia a bit, have been flown to Ukraine, then moved to Slovakia, and then...
Illegally?
Illegally.
Well, out of war, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I mean,
So thankfully, like, the Ukrainians are like they're very resilient people. Like, we'll get onto it. We're just back from there. And they kept them out of Kyiv, and the city was saved. They didn't get into the city center. And then the Russians went away to eastern Ukraine. Then the clinic hadn't fully enacted that force majeure. They just said, we've reserved the right to do it.
Yeah.
And obviously, they don't know if they're like the existence of the clinic will exist anymore. Yeah. It's understandable. It calmed down and just life got back to a bit of normal.
But at this point, we went back to the borders, police said, and we looked again into Canada. We looked again into Mexico, and they knew that situation in the Ukraine, so they upped their prices dramatically, which made it even more impossible for us to look into doing that. So we're like, okay, we just need to work our way in Australia to see if we can actually find an angel that does it for us. And we had these two more embryos that we were able to create. And all of a sudden, they say, like, we are going to open our operation again. Are you interested in bringing your embryos back from Slovakia to Kyiv? So Paul and I were waiting the whole situation. We had already given 30% upfront. And at this point, our chances were null. Like, whether we were doing it in Mexico, we had no embryos anywhere else. These were, like, the last two. Yeah. And we were like, shall we do it? If it's in God's hands to do it, let's just do it.
So are you talking about the embryos coming back from Slovakia into Kyiv?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And
so, but the war still wasn't over, though. So
It's still ongoing, but it was... It's been more concentrated to the east of the country, like, quite far away. So... Yeah. Life seemed to just get back to complete normality, really, in the city, and everything opened up. And they're like, okay, we're going to restart the process again. And okay, they're like, do you want to do it? And so we just had a like pretty simple chat going, look, are we prepared to go into like a war zone? It's not, Kyiv is fine. It's not a war zone, but like the country is at war.
Mm.
Are we prepared to go there if we're lucky enough to have a baby? And we're just, instantly the two of us just said yes, and we're like, oh, okay, well, let's just keep going with the process, let's do it. So probably within 6 weeks, I'd say.
That was July, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, like,
and then in July, August, we were put back into that waiting list of getting a surrogate. But by the end of August, they said, we have this lady, She is your potential surrogate and you guys want to meet her. Which, just as a parenthesis as well, like I told you that everything had been done online. So at this point, everything that we have signed, we never went to Kyiv before. Everything that we signed was online. All the power of attorneys and everything that we had to go through, we sent them via mail. So everything's been done online to this point. And so meeting the surrogate was no exception. We met and we just had a FaceTime call with her, with an interpreter, because she has no English at all, not even a hello, nothing. But I genuinely seen the moment I saw her, I was like, it's her. She was just very genuine, like asking really good questions on why do we want to do this? Why was she doing this? How is her lifestyle? Was the baby going to have grandparents or not? Just really looking at the environment that she, you know.
Had she already been a surrogate?
No, but her sister had.
Okay.
So she knew the process. Her sister had actually mentioned that to her, and she knew that it was something that could help them. You have to remember that now they're in war and that jobs are scarce and they just need to provide for their family as well.
Does she have children?
Three. Okay. Three kids. Yeah.
And can I ask you, Martha, and then I'll ask you as well, Paul, how did you come to terms with the fact that you needed to actually have another woman carry your baby? Was that difficult for you to get your head around? Or did you just, you wanted this baby, so you're like, I'm going to do whatever I can, obviously to the best of my ability, but was it difficult for you? Was there moments of, oh my God, I couldn't have another woman carry my baby?
Or, no.
No?
Okay. No, to be honest, like to me, again, from people that have gone through IVF and surrogacy and whatnot, they blame themselves not being able to carry kids or not being women enough. But genuinely, I never felt like that. It's not my fault. I didn't create this on me. It's just, I just can't. So if I can't, what can I do to make it happen? Okay. And if this was the way, then thankfully, we have all these new technology and science that can help us doing this. So if we can and it's possible and we find the right ways and means, then I genuinely never felt, you know, it's just like, well, I can't. That's it. I can't. Physically, I can't. So.
Okay. And you, Paul, then obviously she's your wife. You just want
have a baby. We're pretty open when we talk and we just said, look, we're just going to explore like every avenue that we can possibly do. And if every avenue is something that is just not fruitful, then okay, we would accept. We have tried everything possible we can to make this happen. And that's just after the surgeons have said, look, just not, no more tries, really. We just go, okay.
Next step.
Like, yeah, it's not great news to hear, obviously, but we were just like, okay, what's the next step that we can do to try and make this happen? And then surrogacy was it. So that just gave us focus to try and do it. And yeah, and we just explored it. Like, so, you know, I think we both dealt with it really well. And I think you're right. It's just, it's not from any fault of my own. So, like, so I can't blame myself. And I think, like, at the start of the process, I think maybe, again, probably this, like, Irish Catholic guilt from you. I think we were just, like, reluctant to maybe tell many people that we're doing this. Because, as you said, we'd had, like, miscarriages and stuff like that. And we were always really reluctant to tell anybody that we were pregnant, ever, because that losing a few miscarriages, obviously, I'm not holding baby, but it's devastating for everyone involved. And then you're just really, you're like apprehensive about sharing that with people, because I just didn't want to say, oh, how's it going? And you go, well, actually, that kind of conversation. And I just felt really exposed, like saying, or being in that position. So I was just like, I just don't want to tell anybody until we've more certainty. So even when our surrogate was pregnant, like we didn't really tell anybody until after 20 weeks.
Yeah.
No, didn't really want to tell
anybody. We couldn't even believe it.
Because we couldn't believe it. It had always been disappointment. So we were afraid to kind of get our hopes up. And that's what it was. So we were just...
Not to me. I didn't feel like that. But it was just more like, well, you know, I'm very happy. Like when we found out that she was pregnant.
Did she get pregnant on the first go?
The first go.
Yeah.
So I can say.
How many embryos did you transfer into
two?
Two.
Yeah. Because we were
going to take the decision whether or not.
Yeah. We were like, again, we're on these all the way.
You're maximizing your potential, aren't you? Yeah. Like, throw two in there and see.
Well, all the embryologists, all the IVF doctors say statistically, like, there's no better chance by putting a second embryo there. Like they said, like, it's not a better odds of resulting in a pregnancy. Like okay. One or two, it's the same chances. And okay. Like in your head, it's hard to fathom that. You're like, nah, it's got to be like, throw another one in just for the crack. Like, and see.
Because we have loads, you know.
Yeah.
So spare another one. So
yeah.
Again, so we found her in August. In September, she got her period and she got the stimulation process. And so in October, they did the transfer, the 14th of October. And that's another story that Polly tells very well because it's worth telling.
So we'd actually come to visit like my mom here for a few days. It's so far to travel from Australia and there's so many places we'd want to go try and see in Europe. So we're like, okay, we'll spend a little bit of time here. Then we went to Iceland. So we're in Iceland for 5 days. And on that day, the 14th, we had gone to this like volcano hike and we were getting messages going, hey, the transfer is soon and stuff like that. And I started getting like all these real poignant thoughts in my head going, we're standing here on a volcano. There's all this like fire and it's the whole country is full of ice and snow. They're saying like the country gets bigger all the time because the volcano stuff, the rock, it's just making the land bigger and bigger. Yeah. So it's like, it's just new life always beginning here. And I said, this is so poignant for us because Martha being a kind of fiery Mexican and me being a kind of cold European, I was like, fire and ice, the beginning of life here in Iceland, and the embryo transfer is happening this day. And I just had a really good feeling from that. We're literally on the top of the world here where life is beginning, and hopefully it's beginning for us like in Ukraine. And I got her getting nearly sentimental, like talking about this and saying it to her.
And a 12-kilometer walk on a 3rd degree Celsius hike, that's how it felt the whole journey, like a never-ending journey. Like, we weren't prepared for those 12Ks on that day for us to hike that long, but at the end we had a goal and we were focused and we had that resilience that is, we'll finish and the whole day, like, it just combined into these feelings. And that's when the transfer happened, and within 10 days, not even the 2-week wait, within 10 days he's like, yeah, she's pregnant. And I'm like, yeah, right. No, she is. It's like, yeah, I want to see the blood one. It's, yeah, numbers are high. She is pregnant. And I'm like, great. So Polly's like, oh, what if it doesn't happen? I wasn't like that. I was just like, okay, but it's for me. It's for us. We're going to keep it to ourselves because I'm going to enjoy the happiness that it means that the first go, it was just more the naivety of the first go, like after all everything we've done and trials and everything, at the first go is actually happening.
What kind of statistics, or do you have them that it would happen on the first go and then that it wouldn't miscarry either? Is there statistics that you were told? Or
not really. I think we just like, just from the IVF statistics that we're working off, because you do an IVF cycle and there's a frozen embryo transfer is a higher success rate than a fresh embryo transfer. And it's purely, because I think what they said is that if you've just been like hyper-stimulated with all the injections, and then they do the egg harvesting, and then a few days later, then they're kind of putting something back in, like your body is still hormonally like quite all over the place. Okay. Whereas that's why they prefer, it has a higher success rate if you they're frozen, and then you go through one more menstrual cycle, and then they do the implantation at the right time.
Okay.
Because your body's back to normal. It doesn't have all this like different like hormonal imbalances from all the injections. So that's why they say statistically it's better to do a frozen embryo transfer than a fresh. And then it's all, again, because of our age, your body over 35, the quality of eggs deteriorate a lot and there's a lower chance. So I think for us statistically, I think it was about a 14% chance of resulting in a successful live birth is what they use as their measure.
Okay.
From like a frozen embryo transfer for an egg of our age, essentially. Chances were statistically low, but we had just prepared ourselves going, okay, well then the first one probably won't work.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go again and we'll just do it until we can't anymore. But it worked out first time. Yeah, we found out the pregnancy. Yeah. We could go. Luckily, our agency, the clinic that they work with, we could actually be there for some of the scans, like in FaceTime and stuff. And then the first time I think we saw the heartbeat, I think the two of us nearly cried. Yeah. It's just really like we were sitting in our
house. And
was
the surrogate happy as well? Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, she's...
Yeah.
When she sees that too, we... Yeah. Watching her face too.
Yeah. So we decided to actually have a relationship with her. You have the right not to. And she has also the right to say, I don't want to have a relationship with you. But we were lucky enough that she wanted to have a relationship with us. Yeah. Not we're not the best of friends, because obviously we have different cultures and whatnot. But, you know, she would send pictures of her belly and she will say, oh, she's moving a lot today, or I'm feeling sick today, or whatever it was.
Okay. And did you find out that it was a little girl from the start?
No. At a point in time where they could tell. We said, okay, don't tell us. We want to have, like, just have some kind of, not one of those real, like, tacky gender reveals where we're like, oh, let's, like, burn tires of, like, blue or pig smoke, and nothing crazy like that. But we just wanted to have it, like, an intimate reveal with our families.
Okay.
Because my mom was obviously here. Her parents and brother and stuff are in Mexico, and we're in Australia. So we're like, we'd want to. So they go, we will give us three contacts. We got her brother's girlfriend, and my friend from uni here, who knows my mom quite very well, and our local friend where we live in Australia. So we gave them the number, the clinic, their numbers, and they messaged and said the sex of the baby.
Okay.
And they had arranged, oh, we got it coordinated. It was
7 a.m. for us.
7 a.m. for us, and 7 p.m. in Mexico, and it was a suitable time in Dublin. And had a balloon that would have different, like, colored confetti pretty much for whichever sex of the baby it was. And Marta's brother's girlfriend is, like, kind of like has like an artistic type of stuff. And so it made these kind of like.
She went,
like,
all in.
It went all in. So the balloons, but it went all in with more stuff. But they were like these kind of Roman candles that would light with a particular color depending on boy or girl. Now, trying to coordinate this over Zoom with a little bit of a time lag of different time zones, we were trying to implement, like, a countdown with this. And we said, will we do the countdown now? And I think in Mexico, they just heard countdown. So they lit the Roman candles. And I saw them doing this going, oh, what's going on now? And then they just started going. We were like, okay, let's burst it. But they started, like, flaring up pink stuff straight away, pink smoke. And we were like,
we were frozen, what? Like, what? Yeah.
And they were like, okay. And then just bang, popped it. And then my mom was like, what do we do now? What do we do now? And then she popped it.
Irish people last.
Yeah, and then she popped it and got an almighty fright from it. I was like, you were expecting the balloon to explode. Like, how can you get a fright from it? But it was just pink stuff all over the screens. But no, it's really cool. And I think from talking to our surrogate mother, she has two boys and a girl. And she goes, I was only ever sick with a girl, and with the boys, nothing wrong. No morning sickness, no nothing. And this whole time with our baby, she was like, yeah, no butter, all fine. So we were just like convinced it's a boy.
Okay.
Convinced. And then I saw the pink smoke, and I think I was just more like, no, really? Just shocked. I think I just mentally prepared it as a boy, and I just took it like, I was not badly, I was just really more surprised.
Oh yeah, it's shocking when you think you're going to have one and not another.
I think it was just a surprise. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's delighted, and Marta's like, oh, she little girl, like, well, just, they love their daddy. Like,
especially when they look exactly like her.
Yeah. She's literally like, when I was older, I was like holding like a mini version of you.
Which is really weird.
It's really strange.
Yeah. I would say so. Yeah,
James, the video. James, like, sent back, Jesus. So her pregnancy went well. And then obviously, though, the war is still going on. So how do you even... Are you not worried all the time?
Yes.
Okay.
Of course you are. But I would actually ask her. Oh, that was actually one thing when we spoke to her. It's like, where do you live? Where in the Ukraine do you live? So we were told where she lived. And I was looking at the maps and just routes of where the next major city was. And it was like 200 km away from her little village, because she lives in a tiny little village. And so I'm like, if Russians were to invade these little tiny villages, they have nothing to do here. There's really the risk of something happening in there is very small. So I felt very confident. I was like, okay, nothing's really going to happen to them. Then winter came along as well. So there were the blackouts as well by the Russians, where they had no electricity and whatnot.
They kept hitting all the energy infrastructure.
So I was like, how do you need anything? Do you need us to send you whatever you need? She's like, no, we have a wooden... stove, so we're fine. She will actually grow all her vegetables and everything. So it's a little tiny village. Like they're self-sufficient.
Were you in contact with her
on Telegram.
On Telegram.
Mm-hmm.
And how often did it happen?
Once a week.
Okay.
Yeah. Or more. Even more. Yeah.
Yeah.
We just Telegram. Chat with her. It's just like WhatsApp.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's like on your phones.
I was thinking
paper.
No.
Pigeons or something.
Sending pigeons.
No. Trust me, Ukraine has a very good internet system. You'll be very surprised. Okay. Better than Australia, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can I just ask you another thing? Because you know the way people may consider surrogacy to be taking advantage of someone that's less well off or more vulnerable than you are. The typical thought process might be, this is a woman who clearly needs money because she lives in a poorer country than you do, and therefore that is the only reason why she's doing it. Have you experienced that thought process yourselves, or mm-hmm. and gone through it and talked about it, and how do you reason it out with yourselves then?
Well, I think for us, there are some articles like in a lot of media about some like agencies here that are not very well regarded, and they don't treat surrogate mothers well. So right from the outset, like Martha was saying at the start, it was key for us that we had a reputable agency that treated surrogate mothers well and made sure that there was like health insurance policies, everything that was covered for them. And that was really important for us. There are some that have a kind of a bad name and give it bad names. And I think there can be some negative stories about them from slightly biased journalists that kind of like do it. It would go in maybe with a kind of strong religious views or something on it, and maybe write it with a bit of an angle.
Yeah.
Now, our surrogate mother was one of our questions. Obviously, they're financially compensated, and we were just saying, why do you want to do it? And she's like, well, it will afford us to be able to like get another home. Like, they were not in desperate need of money, but she was saw it as, because her sister had done, she goes, it's an opportunity for me to actually give my family a better life. Not that I desperately need it. It's an opportunity for me to get a bigger home and to provide my family with a better and bigger home.
Okay.
So that's why she decided to do it. And there's a lot of screening goes into it. And like I said, there's a lot of like mental health checks and other health checks as well. So we did not feel that anyone was being taken advantage of. I think, and because it's legislated for, I think for us, that was really important that there was protections like for her and for us in everything, and it's all above board and not some kind of back alley clinic that's operating like the kind of that gray area in the middle of the law. That was important for us. I think education is key for a lot of people to understand how it works and to not feel like people that don't have a full understanding of it might say, oh, you're just taking advantage, and I don't think that's the case. It's very common in the United States. Are people saying that's taking advantage? I don't think so. It's just because it's just probably not the US that people think that. And
But that's also why we wanted to have a relationship with her, because for us it was not a transaction. This is the woman that is carrying our daughter.
So we want to go back there. We want to visit her. We want to make sure that she's okay, because she's been amazing to provide us with this. And we would, like Martha was saying, if the war got really bad, would we... let's try and bring her family to live with us in Australia. Like, we would do anything for them. That's how we felt about it. There's a bunch of
surrogacy.
Like, there's a bunch of support, like surrogacy groups that are, they're actually a good wealth of information. Like, there's some for different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And we found them like very, like just resourceful for how do you get in and out of the country in the wartime, et cetera, et cetera. Because there's no flights. It's all trains or buses or cars, et cetera. But there's some people on there that, to be honest, it quite annoyed me, because they were just saying, how do I get in for the birth and I get out of that country in the same day? And I'm like, you don't really care about anybody else or the surrogate mother or anything. And that really annoyed me. Whereas our friend that we'd met in Australia, like they've talk multiple times a day, and I've met her, and like they have a great relationship, and they're gonna go and spend 2 months there for their baby's birth, and really want to spend like that, get to know people, and just spend a lot of time there and get to know the person and look after them. And that was very important for us. We wanted to have that relationship.
And that was people that were in Canada, was it? Was that the people that had the surrogate in Canada?
No, these are friends of ours in Australia that are going to experience a similar process. They want to do that. And it's amazing. But there's some people, not to point fingers, but they were generally American that were like that very... this is a transaction and we're very kind of disregarding and really just lacked a lot of empathy, I think, to surrogate mothers. And that just didn't really suit the damn well with me. And many times I felt like commenting them, like, what kind of person are you? But I just held my tongue because it's a support group and it's not really the place for me to do that. But that's just, it rubbed me up the wrong way.
Well, you're not an argumentative person anyway, Paul. So
no, I'm a big pushover, as you know.
So let's, I suppose, fast forward, was there any bumps in the road in terms of the pregnancy and you being very worried about her with the way the war was going on?
She was like the most relaxed person. Yes. Like anytime we talked to her, like, is everything okay? She goes, everything's fine. We're good. Don't worry. I'm fine. I'm good. It's always super cool, super relaxed. And that gave us a lot of confidence because we were obviously hearing about missiles, all that kind of stuff going, God, I hope she's okay. Everything was always fine. For some of the bigger scans, she would go to Kyiv for these and we'd be worried, really worried. But super calm, it was all fine. Towards the end of the pregnancy, she had a gynecological check, not a scan. And it was said that, maybe she had a shortened cervix. So that increases the risk of coming early massively. So we were okay, we probably need to plan on going soon. And your brother has actually been amazing, we could just ask a question. I said, James, what's this? And first off, he was just thinking very clinically going, did they do any kind of scan? And I go, no. And he goes, then this is subjective. Wait until they do a scan and they actually do proper measurements, then see what the story is. So they did a scan. And they go, actually, it's false alarm. It's all fine.
However, because they live outside of Kyiv and births need to happen in Kyiv. That is just because the whole setup is in Kyiv. They moved the surrogate mothers to Kyiv at 37 weeks of pregnancy. But because of this, they had to move her early just in case, just really to look after her and after the baby. Let's bring her to Kyiv early and keep an eye on them. So she had to move to Kyiv within week 34.
Okay.
So this is weeks of her not being with her family by herself and just with one or two more surrogates that are also due soon. But this is all this time of her not being with her family. So in Kyiv, where there's war and there's all these raid alarms and not being with your family and being heavily pregnant.
That's tough on her, yeah.
Yeah, of course. And so we all thought that she was going to be early. To our surprise, she was 2 weeks late.
Oh, God, the poor woman.
Yeah, it was 41 weeks and 2 days.
That was your genes, dude.
Well, apparently so, yeah. So I was 2 weeks overdue as a baby and my mom doesn't let me forget about it. So, yeah, she 41 weeks and 2 days, she was born. And we got to Kyiv expecting it to be early. We spent a few weeks there. The city is pretty normal. We did tours with a tour guide.
How did you get into Kyiv?
We took the train from Poland. Okay. There's zero flights in the whole country. Total no flies.
And how long of a train journey is that?
It took about 19 hours from Warsaw direct in. So you cross, you get to the stop at the border. We stopped for about an hour and a half. You just cross the border. More passport checks, it's fine.
They need to change the rails.
Yeah. So yeah, the rail, you would imagine two neighboring countries would have the same rail system. No, the Ukrainian rail system is wider. The tracks are wider than the Polish one. So they cross a border and then they have to go into this train yard and just widen the wheel axles on every carriage. And then it can continue on its way to Kyiv. And they do that for every train journey that comes in there. Yeah, it's crazy. It's mad. But so we did that. And we were on my phone the minute we crossed the border. And we both were oh my God, we're actually here. Yeah. This is nuts.
What week of the pregnancy was that?
30.
39. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's quite
early.
So did you get to meet her before she went into labor?
As soon as we arrived in Kyiv, We did like, not.
Let's go on the piss.
No, that was.
We got, yeah. Well, I was kind of done with a beer after that. But yeah, no, we were like, we would like to meet her straight away. And they brought us to her apartment and we met outside. And yeah, we were just. Couldn't believe it. Like, we were
even
just,
before dropping our stuff in our apartment. No, we have to go see her like today. That was our condition. We're here for her and for the baby. And so our tiredness can wait. So we need to go and meet her. And so we did.
So yeah, we went to go meet her and a lot of tears were shed and hands in the belly. And we're just like, going, oh my God, it's like just, it's like.
Was it a big old bump or was it nice and neat? Well,
no, it was nice and neat to me because she's actually, she's very a tall, tall lady. She, okay, so and taller. Broad as shoulder. It's not like heavy set or anything, but just like solid because one of her flatmates was another surrogate, like mother who was, we found out afterwards, actually it was holding twins, but she was shorter. And had this most humongous belly. And we were, when we saw our, like, Tatiana beside her, we were like, oh my God. We were kind of like, oh, is everything okay? Like, it was just a neat little bump. But, like, she turned out to be quite a, like, 3.6 kilo baby. And so, yeah, she was pretty, she's long. She's like 55 centimeters. So she's like, some like 99% of her, like the length of them, which we're not NBA players, so I don't know where they got that height.
Certainly not.
Yeah. But yeah, no, so that we went to see her straight away. And then obviously she was born probably about 2 weeks after we arrived there. Yeah, so we would like go out for lunch with her a few times and just wanted to like see how she was and see if she needed anything. And yeah, no, she was.
We had that conversation with her because she was like, after she's born, you and I are not going to talk anymore. I'm like, what are you talking about? Unless you don't want to, would you be okay if down the line our daughter wants to meet you? Would you be okay? She's like, well, if you're okay, it's like, well, we are. Like, we're actually going to tell our daughter the whole story, but we just want to know if you'll be okay for us to come to Ukraine and for her to meet you. She's like, yeah. She actually asked, oh, as soon as the baby's with her grandparents, I want pictures. And, aww, you know, like, she went to see us after the birth the next day or two to meet the baby, and we wanted her to hold her as well. And it is obviously a psychological burden for some of them, but she was very okay with that. And so were we. So that's why we wanted to have all those months that we couldn't actually meet her or be with her or hold her hand to at least a couple of weeks to spend as much as we could with her. And it was difficult. I mean, we're having Google Translator really doing the job and sometimes very poor job. But like we just really wanted to be with them and wait there with them. And yeah.
And how did the delivery happen? Were you there, Martha?
I was there.
Were you there, Paul?
No, only the ladies are allowed.
Okay, fair enough.
Not the men.
Okay.
Yeah, which, yeah.
And what was that like?
It was, surreal? Out of this, of course. Yeah. I'm seeing my daughter being born from another woman's body. And like, despite knowing who she is, I didn't know if it was for me okay to touch her and rub her back and being supportive to her, which I was doing anyway. I don't know if she liked it or not, but it was a little shocking, to be honest, to see that this woman is going through all this pain for us, for whatever amount of money or not, like she's still putting her body into this stress for us. And after that, still being happy to see us and to see the baby and everything. So money or not, she's still an angel to us.
Of course.
Yeah.
And was the baby given to you then?
Immediately. Yeah. So it was pretty much holding her hand and seeing the baby. And it's like, go to your baby. I'm like, okay, like, I don't want to leave you. Because I know you're suffering, but my baby. Okay. So no, I ran to her and they gave me the baby straight out. And and that's it. They just gave me the baby and nothing else was said.
There you go.
It was pretty much. So like we part of the around the delivery days is they'll put you up in like a room in the hotel. It's a hospital. It's one of the city is like 7 dedicated maternity hospitals. And this was like one of them. And like it's old, but it's like, it's their total specialization. So we were like totally fine with it. And so we could stay in a room there and Martha got the shout. We'd actually been there from the day before because they were like, oh, if nothing's happened by this date, then we'll bring her into the hospital to induce her. And she's obviously quite far gone at this point over. And we went to the hospital and we're like, we'll be here from the very start. Nothing all day, nothing. But we hadn't got a full idea of what the plan was. And then they go, okay, at 9 p.m., we're going to do this type of inducement with a type of balloon or something.
And we're asking James, what does that mean?
We're going to put it in at 9 p.m. And we were like, we've been here all day. Like, why 9 p.m.? And then I called your brother again. And I was like, why would they do this? And he goes, that's just like the people that work there. Like, they don't want to be doing a birth in the middle of the night. So they put them in at nighttime and give it the 8 to 12 hours it needs to work. And then when they come in to work, then the baby will be born sometime during their shift. It's just them being, they don't want to come in the middle of the night. And I was like, okay. He goes, happens all over the world. And I go, okay. So we went to sleep that night. Next morning, they had to remove the balloon. And we were like, okay, so does a birth like happen like right now or what? Because we obviously don't have any experience
with
this. Yeah, we're just hadn't got a clue. So then eventually, like, we kind of pushed them, going to just tell us what's going to happen. They go, okay, generally, maybe 7 to 10 hours from the removal, it could be happen for like stuff that, like, for more dilation and contractions to get stronger. And then the second phase, it's 2 hours and it's quite intense, and then birth. And we're like, okay, now we can mentally not be stressing about not hearing anything and not knowing what's happening. We'll wait. Literally, like 10 minutes later, they ring her and go, we're going to bring her down very shortly. She's gone into labor, like, properly now. And we're like, holy shit, like, we've been waiting years for this. And now when we hear this call, we're like, we don't have anything ready. What are we going to do? And just started panicking. So Martha went down to the delivery room with the surrogate, and I just waited in the room, and I'm just like pacing around. And I just said, the one thing I said you have to do is you just have to give me like updates, please. The worst thing you can do to me is just not keep me informed about what is happening, because I'd go nuts.
Yeah.
So I was pacing around and messaging, going, oh, this is happening. Doctors here are gone. And then she sent me a message going, oh, actually, a few medical people have just come in now. And then with silence for like 20 minutes. And I'm like, is something wrong? Yeah. What's going on? You can't just leave it like that to me. Like,
you left him hanging.
Oh, I was stressing.
He didn't know. I was paying attention to something more important. So
I was stressing like crazy. But yeah, so then all the birth happened, and they just, Martha had her baby. And they go, here you go. So we were in the hospital for 3 more days. And I think we'd expected that like somebody might show us a little bit of how to handle the baby or what to do with a baby. We were kind of pretty much on our own. Once a day, the pediatrician and the doctors would come in just to check her weight and see if she's okay. But we hadn't got a clue like what we were doing. Then eventually, I went down to ask on how much do we feed the baby? And then again, I talked to your brother again. He goes, he just told me the chart going, this much per kilo per day. I was like, just tell me the main. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, for anyone else listening, my brother is a pediatrician, so that's why he's not an obstetrician, he's a pediatrician. Yeah. But he thinks he knows everything about everything, doesn't he?
He's a smart guy, but yeah. But so we just looked after her for the days, and then we were going to check out of the hospital. We had all the scans, and everything was fine.
Yeah, but at this point, we've been 2 weeks in the Kyiv, and we have experienced a few air raids. Actually, the second night that we were in Kyiv, we experienced 4 air raids in one single night.
Yeah, there's like 40 cruise missiles. Scary. The first, we'd heard a few nights before at different air raids, and I heard them, and like the kind of child in me got excited about it. Like, it's weird. That's weird. I was like, oh my God, like air raids, this is like real, this is cool. Like, blah, blah. And I was like, no, like obviously it's like a terrible thing's happened, but it was just that inner child in me felt like that. We went down to the basement in our building that we just got an Airbnb, like it's the city, like it's open for business. We went down there, nothing happened, no neighbors, didn't see anything. Then a few nights later, this 4 in one night, so we were just exhausted. And I'm working from there as well.
Okay.
So I was just absolutely shattered, like trying to like.
And work. Is the air raid just, what is it? Is it missiles coming in, or is it just?
It's for generally. It's for missiles or for, they have these drones. Like kamikaze drones. So they buy them and they just fly into a building and blow up. So,
but do they fly into buildings that aren't occupied?
They fly anywhere, like military targets, like any other buildings. But
could it have been easily been the building that you were in?
It could have been. Generally, they're given, I think they're like, not that I'm a Russian military strategist, but I think they're given a specific target. But what happens is in Ukraine, they've got the best air defense systems from like every country in the world, the Americans, the British, the Norwegians, everyone has given them like their best air defense system. And it's all in Kyiv. Like other cities have some, but not to the same protection as Kyiv has. So what happens is drones fly slower or the missiles are much faster. They can take any of them out. But what happens is the debris from them falling from the sky is where most deaths had occurred in Kyiv from them, because they wouldn't hit any targets, but they'd be taken out in the sky and fall, and
okay.
There'd be like burning wreckage that might hit apartment buildings, so people hadn't gone to a shelter. So that was always a bit in our mind, but the city's like humongous. So yeah. We were going, all right, statistically, yeah. Like really.
Our thought process was
what we were like thinking analytically, going like, it's so big, really, yeah. What are the
odds? It's like winning the lottery. I mean, it's yeah. Such a big city. And for yeah. Your building to be the one among the whole city to be strike,
yeah.
It's one
yeah.
In but, a million.
But so how long did you stay in Kyiv then after the baby was born?
Probably about another 2 weeks. So we spent a full month in total. And
did you have to stay there for the 2 weeks afterwards?
So we needed a number of days after the birth we were discharged. The following day we could get a birth certificate. But we wanted to get like a few additional birth certificates because... down the line, if you need some, it's a difficult place for us to probably go and contact, or can we get another birth cert? So we're like, we'll just get a bunch of them now. But you can only get one issue per day. And we also need one of them to get like that. You know, that kind of government, you say you can get like a certified document, then you get a notarized document. And then the creme de la creme is apostille. So it's a government certified thing that anyone can look up an apostille register and go, yeah, I know this document is legitimate. So that's just like, to further authenticate it. So that took about 8 days for us to get.
And are both your names on her certificate?
Yes.
That's actually
one of the other reasons why we chose Ukraine. Yeah.
Ukraine is both of our names are down as like the birth parents of the baby. So okay. That would help with just make citizenship, any of that kind of stuff, just more straightforward.
Because I thought that it was difficult to get your name on mm-hmm. it because another woman had given birth.
No, so in Ukraine, it is typified to be like that.
Okay.
For example, in Australia, despite it being legal and it's altruistic, the mother, the surrogate mother, is the legal mother. And so once the baby turns one or whatnot,
yeah,
they need to go to parental court and then she will give the rights to the intended parents.
Yeah.
But in Ukraine, it's not like that because legally, the rights are like from the very beginning, the intended parents are the parents.
Yeah.
Okay.
So even though her baby was born in Ukraine, she had no right to Ukrainian citizenship.
Okay.
Because it's all legislated for and mm-hmm. It's all very clear what it is. So they go, okay, you're the birth parents. You should not be a Ukrainian citizen, etc. All that kind of stuff. So that was kind of one of the things that we liked about it as well.
Okay.
But other countries, yeah. And I think, obviously, I'm an Irish citizen, but I didn't want to explore the Irish route because I know here that... I think from different things I was reading is that like the mother is not recognized as a guardian or a parent. That's right, only the father. And it takes time, like a lot of court issues, I think, to change that.
Is that for Irish parents that use a Ukrainian surrogate? Mm-hmm. They can't, but because you are Australian citizens, it's different.
Yeah, so we didn't explore the Irish way at all. We're just
yeah, because that's why I asked you to confirm that, because I know of a couple of Irish people who have had their babies born by surrogate over in Ukraine, and they were highlighting the fact that the mother wasn't on the birth certificate.
Yeah.
That's why I was asking you, but it's because of the country that you came from and the laws yeah. there rather than the laws in Ukraine.
I know. I think the laws in Ukraine, I think both would be yeah. on the birth certificate, but I think it's the Irish authorities that don't recognise that birth cert in full. They go, you're not the birth mother. So you're not, I think there's, look, again, I'm not a pro on the Irish side of it, but just from exploring that avenue, we just didn't want to do that because there was a thing like we don't live here. So we didn't want to had to go to court here or change that yeah. or anything like that. But I just know from certain other people that I've talked to and things I've read, like there was various news articles that the birth mother is recognized as the mother. And yeah. there was complications where if we came back and our baby was sick and say, just worst case scenario, say I got hit by a bus, Martha could not make any decisions for the baby because she wouldn't be recognized as the parent at the time.
Okay.
So it was just all this stuff that it just didn't sit well with us. And we were like, we're just not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Australia is more straightforward. And
okay. So it's because of the country that you originated from, technically being Australia, and the way that you came from there, that was how this all worked out well for you in terms of being the recognised mm-hmm. parents mm-hmm. on the birth certificate.
Yeah, Australia is a lot more kind of I think progressive on that front.
Do you reckon Australia is a little bit more progressive with everything on every front. We could be here for hours comparing
with a lot of things. I think even applying for her passport, like there's specific forms for like a child born via surrogacy. There's very clear things that like processes for it, and it's accepted. Remember we were saying like it's like different states have different views on what you can and can't do, but that's just state law. Federally, like for citizenship, for passports, it's all like they have different processes for like passports, for citizenship, etc. So
how did you go about getting her passport then? Because obviously she can't leave Ukraine without a passport, is that right?
That's the other part of the thing. So she's finally born, thankfully. She's all good and we're getting her birth certificate. And now we need to apply for Australian citizenship and her passport. So the Australian citizenship with the birth certificate, Polly went online, applied for citizenship. They took their time to get that done. But then for us to get the passport, the Australian government is not working in Ukraine, so they're working out in Poland. And the process is that once you get citizenship, one of the parents need to go to an active embassy, whether in Poland or in Vienna, and they need to go and get the passport of the baby and then come back to the Ukraine. So that meant that Polly would have to be out of the Ukraine, leaving us behind in Kyiv. And that was something that I never felt comfortable on doing, but we were like, okay, if that's what we need to do, we will do it. But when she was exactly a week old, and those air raids now really hit us. Like, we woke up to a very strange sound and the building shook us, and we heard a few more strikes happening very, very, very close to us. So I just grabbed the baby and left the building, and I was just like, there's no way you're leaving us behind. There's just no way you are leaving us behind. So we have to find a way to go out as soon as possible. So we were waiting for that birth certificate to be apostille, because that would be the only really true document that we had in our hands for her. And we decided to hire a driver, and this person took us from Lviv to Warsaw and helped us crossing the border. And the Polish border was very well known to, you know, that it's like, okay, well, your embassy is not working in Ukraine. You have the right and grounds on taking this baby out on a birth certificate. So we took a train again.
Yeah. So,
but suddenly we were like, okay, yeah, we have actually found a driver for you to go and to go to Warsaw, but you need to leave tonight to Lviv, which is another city in Ukraine. And then from Lviv, this person is going to wait for you guys and drive you through the border. To find trains in the Ukraine is next to impossible, because it's pretty much the only way.
There's no flights. No flights. It's the only way they can travel.
Yeah.
They're hard to get, like tickets. And they just said, can you be in Lviv by tomorrow morning to chance it with this driver? Which we were like, after that air raid, give a little context, like those air raids, like generally, their technology is amazing. Like, nearly all automated alerts. So the minute a plane takes off in Russia, it will let you know. And I said, there's planes in the air, and they'll know the type of plane, and some of them carry these like hypersonic missiles that can be anywhere in a matter of minutes. So if one of them takes off, the whole country is air raids, just to say, beware. I think a lot of the Ukrainian people, like, it's like fatigue of these things. You hear it so much. It's like the Boya Gradwell. So they just don't pay as much attention to it so much anymore. So this particular night when their building shook, we just thought it was only drones. So drones, you're like, that's the mentality, like, whatever. Like, we went back to sleep. But because they'd, like, sent them to Kyiv from about 10 different directions, it just meant that the air defenses had to work harder, a bit scrambled, and things got closer. So they exploded, like, an hour and a half after alerts, we were like, we'll go back to sleep. Exploded outside, shook our building, scared, and we were like, I was like, that's a missile. I was like, let's get the hell out of here. Martha just didn't even think that. She just grabbed the baby and was gone. I was there going, what about me? But then we heard a few more in quick succession. I was like, holy moly, like the sound of them was unbelievable. So we spent a few hours in the basement and waited. And a lot of people in the building were just in their cars, or just some guy was, we went down there, that guy was snoring his head off. It was really funny. He wasn't too fazed. But so we were like, yeah, we'll get out. just heard about this driver. Look, what chance have we got? Nothing to lose. If we don't get over the border, we'll stay in Lviv near the border. I'll go and we'll get the passport or whatever. So they just all of a sudden said, actually, the guy can only do it tomorrow morning or it'll be like pretty much nearly another week. So we're like, okay, so we need to be in Western Ukraine, like miles away by tomorrow morning. So I try to get a train ticket, nothing. They're like, ah, okay, this is not going to work out. So we said, we'll go out for lunch, this Georgian restaurant near us that we liked. And I said, I'll bring my computer with me in the restaurant. I opened it up. Some other train that was coming from a different city, passing through Kyiv and going west, came online. I was like, I got to buy tickets. Couldn't buy them because it would only take a Ukrainian credit card. I was like, so our coordinator.
Only two tickets, by the way.
Pinged her and she goes, yeah, I'll get them. Like within 5 minutes, she'd actually bought the tickets for us and sent them to us. So we're like, all right, we're leaving here in 6 hours. So let's go and pack up all our stuff because we had to take the train overnight from Kyiv, left like 10 p.m., got to Lviv at 6 a.m. A driver guy there, I was writing to him. He's like, oh, money coming back from Poland. This is the night before. But he was there, met us. We got in the car. We drove straight to the border, waited there like probably about an hour. Again, he got through, left the Ukrainian side, went to the Polish side. And he goes, they may ask to interview you or me. So just be fine with that. And I go, I'm not doing anything wrong. So I was like, not worried. But they're like, you out of the car? Me, yeah. Brought me into this. It looked like a big kind of detention building. They were bringing me to like all these gates. It was like when you ever seen prison scenes where they're like, they're going along and they're opening one gate with a key and they go, yeah, through there. I went through about three of these and then into this building and I was like, probably a tiny bit nervous in my head going, it's a very secure building. Yeah. What is it? But it was just a border guard place. So I went in and me and our driver guy, he didn't read much English, but we could understand each other. Just waiting in this totally empty room. And then, so I was like, I'm not worried. What's the worst thing I can do is just say no and we'll go back to Lviv. That's in my head. And they separated us and they go, all right, meet, pointing at me going, come with us. So, okay, why are they separating us? What's going on? So they brought me into a room and I was like, two guys and this other lady. And like the lady had a friendly face, but none of them looked at me or would really talk to me. And I could just see them with their documents. And I was like, okay, passports and the birth cert and all that. And they had a look at mine and kind of left it down. But they were going through Martha's passport, both of Australian passports, but they're going through her passport in a lot of detail. And I could just see them like saying that the stamps in her going Qatar or somewhere else. And like, I don't know if they're profiling her or something, but they didn't care about my passport, but they were giving hers a lot of scrutiny. And then eventually they brought our driver guy in. We're just talking and he just was like going, their embassy is closed. And they've relocated all their staff and they're operating out of Poland. They're going there. I'm going to bring them there and they're going to get the passport there. So they were like, okay, that's fine. Like we had the birth cert, the apostille, our names are on it, yeah. Our documents. And I think it's not the first time that this has happened, like at the border, because a lot of people would have probably left.
Were they profiling you because you're Mexican?
Who knows?
She was still in the car. Like, she didn't ask him in.
Okay. There was an officer that came to the car. He started talking to me. And I'm like, only English, please. He's like, oh, yeah. So when do you have the baby? And it's like, no, it's surrogate baby. Mm-hmm. How old is he? And it's like, 2 weeks. When? Today. Oh, okay. Is she okay? He's like, yeah. It's if you want to see her. And like, she's right here. Mm. I'm like, yeah, okay. So, yeah, he came and checked the baby and...
That's nerve-wracking,
mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
It was a little bit, but like I said, I kind of just...
She's really chilled out there, Paul.
Well, if the thing is, in my head, I was like, I've watched so much of that Nothing to Declare program and all that stuff. And like, if you look really nervous or something like that, then they're like, they've got something to hide or they're doing something wrong. So I was like, well...
You don't have anything.
In my head, I was like, I have nothing to hide. And I said, I'm not going to give them the satisfaction of like looking really nervous and making them scare me. I'm just going to see what happens. So then they were like, yeah, fine. You all go. So we drove a little bit and then it was like another like very, they had to check the bags after and then we drove another bit. There was a tiny wait there and we drove and then like the driver guy was like, welcome to the European Union. So Martha just like broke down in tears and some bits gone.
I broke down when I entered the Ukraine.
So when we looked at our passport stamp, so like a full month we'd spent there, and so we got over the border and we stopped. So he goes, it's not his first rodeo doing this drive, he goes, I know a good place for breakfast down the road, we'll stop there. We're like, okay, sure. We got there, we rang Marta's parents, they were like over the moon. Is that when your mom broke down?
My mom is the strongest woman you've ever met. She will literally be a rock. And when we said that we were out, she's like, I genuinely didn't think that all of this was going to work.
My goodness.
Yeah.
It's been a very few times when I see Vera cried, and this was one of them. I was like, because think about it. We started telling people about our journey when we were like, I don't know, 7 months pregnant, 8 months pregnant.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did James not even know?
I know. We actually told James nearly from the very start, because he was always like a great, like my best friend nearly, and like just obviously just the medical kind of stuff.
He knows so much. He does know so much. I'm taking the mic.
But we didn't really tell, you know.
Okay, so you told your families at
our families knew.
Oh yeah, of course you were talking about the gender reveal, but okay,
but like anyone else, it was just no, we would not volunteer the information, and there was nothing wrong with it, but again, it was our process and we wanted to enjoy ourselves, and obviously the option of something going wrong was always there, but we didn't want to think that could be an option.
Okay.
So until we were like really certain that something was going to happen, we started telling, because also it's like, okay, well, all of a sudden our friends are going to see like, well, you weren't pregnant, so what's going on? Like, how come you just got a baby out of the blue?
Go to Ukraine and steal a baby.
And then
they take one look at it and go, no, actually.
DNA required.
But so you got the passport okay.
So we got over the border and we went to Warsaw. So we got a hotel for it. I just booked it for 4 days and close to the embassy. And we'd already applied for the citizenship at this point, but we were still waiting. Like other people we met, it took 1-2 days for them. We were like day 3-4, till nothing. And I was like trying to ring them going, please, I get up at all hours just to ring Australian time. Please, can you have a look at this? Like, we're dying to get out of here, etc. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen. Then we're in the hotel in Poland.
What was the reason why? Why did they take their time?
Because they don't divulge any reasons why. They just say it will be dealt with when it's dealt with, kind of thing. Like, they don't give
it.
Sounds
a bit like an Irish answer.
A bit, yeah. There's half of them are probably Irish. So one night we were going to bed and it was probably like 11:30 Warsaw time. I think she'd just gotten up and had a feed. And it was like 7:30 Sydney time. And I was like, I'll just check my email. And then all of a sudden, it had come through. I was like, Jesus, somebody's up early and the government there. Like, did we send me the confirmation then? But I was like, okay, apply for the passport now. I applied, sent all the information, and just got the usual generic auto responses. But I didn't notice. It was like, I didn't notice at the time. But the next day, I saw it again. And it goes, actually, there was a link down there saying to book an appointment at the Warsaw Embassy. And I go, click, click, click. So I booked it for this. I found this out on the Wednesday and I booked it for the Friday morning. So yeah, I booked it and I went in with all the documentation. And they're like, they really wanted to see like our passports, proof of our address, the contract for with the surrogate services and the birth certificate and stuff like that. So not too many documents really. Like, I'd brought our whole life with this and they only wanted to see like these certain things.
Okay.
And they go, yeah, all grand, come back, hopefully we'll have it ready in the afternoon. They go, well, we're gonna call your wife in the meantime. So this is a lesson learned for us. Marta's her plan didn't have like roaming, so like, how the hell are you gonna contact her? But we both had Ukrainian numbers that thankfully it worked here. They work everywhere. It's amazing. So they were
Ukrainian
able to call
numbers
her.
Work
yeah
everywhere.
And they're so cheap. The best plans for
so they were able to call her just because they wanted to verify stuff. They had to call like the doctor who like verified the information. They called her surrogate mother and just asked all like whatever pertinent questions they need to. Okay. And they got it, I guess, full on check to make sure like everything's all like above board. So they did that. And then in the afternoon, they rang me and they said, yeah, your passport's ready. So they'll only issue an emergency passport for you to get back to the home country. And then you exchange it and you get the real full one. So we got it and we were like, oh my God, we have a passport. And then, so because we're not far away from Ireland there, we're like, let's go. Like, we'll go see Nana and see, because like, we're so close, it's such a long journey too here, like from Australia. So we're like a few more hours, let's get over there. So, Well, yeah, we just went to look at flights. Surprisingly, there's only Ryanair flight from Warsaw to Dublin, and they were charging like an absolute fortune.
And this is your first experience in flying Ryanair with a child.
Well, no, I didn't subject her to that because the price were like, for Ryanair to fly the two of us with a baby and a few cases was like be about 1,000 or 1,100 euro. And just
like, you have to spend about like 150 grand on a surrogate process. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's no more money.
I was more worried. Well, yeah, we're at that point. Like, it's like you're financially, you've gone through a lot. Yeah. And I think it's just your own experience at Ryanair, all that kind of stuff. Like, they're going to be, we had so much luggage and bags. I was like, it's going to be difficult. Every kilo counts with them. Mm. And then I said, I'll just chance my air miles that I had with Qantas, the Australian airline. They're like, yeah, we have an alliance with Finnair and stuff. We can fly a business class to Helsinki and Helsinki to Dublin for a few, some points and like no money. I was like, okay, let's do it. Like, and it's not full on business class. It's just the front row and a small plane. I was like, don't care. But I just, so
was it a holiday in Helsinki then? Or did you just?
No,
it was just an hour.
Okay.
Yeah, like a couple hours there. That was it. But yeah, we said we could fly. Like, and it just was great
because we had space. Done some traveling.
Yeah.
Well, now she's here.
Think about it. She's been a COVID embryo that flew across the world. And then she's a war baby, has flown across the world. Yeah.
She's been amazing. Like within a few days, like we were out and about in the city center, Kyiv. Like we took around, like the metro system's really impressive with Kyiv. It's 100 meters underground, really old, loud, sleeping in the buggy. Not noise doesn't bother her. She's been everywhere. And if you think about it, we brought her everywhere when normally people like cocoon themselves for like 6 weeks, but we were in a bite and showing her everywhere and just.
But we needed to. Even if all of this situation would have not happened, we still needed to make a long haul travel back to Australia. Yeah. So the sooner that we get her into being out and about and get into the car seat and out and noises and whatnot, it was just going to be easier for her and for us.
Can I ask you actually, because I didn't ask you when we were talking about the pregnancy, was there any time or did it ever like worry you at all that you don't know what that lady is eating or drinking or doing, and you know, regardless of the screenings and everything like that, were you ever worried about this, you know?
Yeah. So I asked her, and the agency actually gives them a list of things that they can't eat, just like pasteurized milk or cheeses and all this stuff. But then asking her as well, because I was like, do you have a supermarket that has everything? And she's like, yes, but I grow most of my veggies. And she will send me pictures like, oh, tonight we're cooking chicken Kyiv, or we're doing borscht. And she will send me pictures of stuff that she will make herself. So again, she was very healthy in that sense, and she will grow everything.
Does she have a husband or a partner?
Yeah, she has a husband. He's an electrician.
And luckily he wasn't like conscripted or anything, so he could be there and be supportive and
look after the kids while she was
away and stuff. Because a lot of like men were like doing the military service and stuff as well. Like we'd see very evident in Kyiv. There's something, you think it's a normal city, but there's a ton of people walking around in like military fatigues because they're on active duty and stuff. So, but now thankfully their family unit was together and they were like eating really healthy. And we only found out actually like after we'd even left Ukraine that they actually, every scan that they would go to, they would do like a blood test for like alcohol and stuff like that. Okay. We didn't actually know that happened, but we weren't concerned.
Yeah.
That's why, like, I think like we were saying, touched on very earlier, like the thing in Canada.
Yeah.
They're very loose with it. And I think there's a lot of probably people that are not adhering to not smoking, drinking, or
doing drugs,
whatever, and that are like going down the process. We just had a lot more kind of confidence in Ukraine, and yeah, we were happy with that.
And can I ask you, and I know it's very, very early days, but would you do it again?
We would do it again, but we need to think about the war situation. Because she's going to be by herself. Like, we don't have any other relatives in Australia. Once Paul and I are gone, it's just going to be her. So it would be lovely to have a sibling. But it is, now we have to think of her. Mm. Like, going into the Ukraine, again, we went into the Ukraine before war. And we were willing to carry on because we had nothing to lose. Now we do. Now, going into Ukraine and leaving her behind is not fair on her.
Mm.
If things change, and hopefully they do, because Ukrainians are really resilient and they're like, they're really epic, like, they're legends, really, all of them. They carry on with their normal lives and hardworking people and really good, supportive people and nice people. We had the best time. But the war is no joke. And we were lucky enough. 8 years in the make, but we were lucky enough to get out of there safe and sound and to have a healthy baby and have a best surrogate possible and have a good agency that we did it with. Like, the situation right now is not ideal, really.
I think I would. Yeah.
Would you?
Yeah, I think so. I was probably less apprehensive going there because I'm careful about what you would read. Like, a lot of, there's no news like bad news. Mm-hmm. So all a lot of people media hear about is just the bad things, but they're, like Marta was saying, they're incredible people. They're very tough, strong, resilient, and very proud, really proud people. And I don't think they would ever be defeated. I think they're incredibly passionate and tough. And yeah, no, I think we would. I think, like, we would do it again. I think maybe our surrogate may want to do it again. You never know. Like, it's just, it's all up near. We just mm-hmm. don't know. So, okay. But I think, like Marta was saying, mm-hmm. it would be awesome to have a sibling.
Yeah.
And yeah, we'll just see what happens. Financially, like, it's a lot of money and we need to just kind of get our resources in order again and just see what happens. But I think we could. Like, we still have some embryos
knocking around.
Frozen over there.
They're
all in the one place here. Well, no,
there's two in Australia.
There's still two in Australia and there's a handful over there still. So.
It's so funny to think of that, though, isn't it? Like, there are
these, you know? The thing about the whole thing is, if I come today without knowing me at all, and it's like, oh yeah, like, I flew all my embryos, I'm going to have a baby in the war zone.
Yeah. You think you're crazy, yeah. So.
You're mad.
Like, oh, I don't know. Well. I just think that, I know that as someone who was really maternal myself, and all I wanted was a baby, I can understand.
Mm.
You'd go to the ends of the earth to have one.
But yeah.
Thankfully, you do have the most beautiful little redhead.
No, we don't know yet. So maybe that might fall off and she'll become, I think for the Australian son, I hope she's more Martha's feature than mine. So. But we'll see.
This has been lovely and I'm sure it's been really informative for a lot of people. But I do ask people at the end of my podcast two questions. I didn't actually tip you guys off.
Oh, yeah, now I'm on the spot here. I'm kind of nervous that you're going to ask me.
I'm so sorry. Because I always send people text, but with you, it's just like, yeah, you're going to come up.
So you're going to call up.
Yeah. So I will ask Martha first, will I?
Yeah.
And Martha, what advice would you give young people today?
Young people, that's a very good one. If I was young again, I would freeze my eggs.
Okay.
Definitely. Especially if you are a woman with a bright career ahead of you and you are focused on that and you are not focused on the partner, which is, you know, fair enough, and it's everyone's choice and certainly was my choice at the time. No one tells you that as you grow older the chances of having a baby are very remote. So I would freeze my embryos. That would be part of something that I think should be taught in school as part of your sexual education, really. Because again, we have the technology now and it's nothing wrong about it. And it just really gives you chances of growing as a professional and also becoming a mother when you're right and when you have found or not the right partner, but when you feel it's the right moment to have kids. That's what I would say to my younger self. And yeah, and to younger people is, if you don't want to wait for a partner per se, you want to do it yourself as a woman, go ahead and do it. But if it's not the right time, at least freeze your eggs.
Okay. And you, what advice did you give young people today?
She stole what I was going to say. But, but I think for young people today, I we grew up in an age when it was just all total digital transformation at the beginning. But I think it's got to be so hard to, the young person growing up today, just so much exposure digitally. I think try and not get sucked into all that, I think. And I think just try and live your best life and have those personal engagements, personal connections rather than digital connections. Because I think that's really the most meaningful kind of communication and kind of relationships you can have with people. And I would try.
Give you a big hug now, Paul. Touch you, not like text you.
But I think that, like, I think so many people are like glued to, like, obviously, most of our lives are run on devices, but they get to a saturation point and they take over, and people are like, don't know how to communicate, like to talk to people. Yeah. They can be really nice or really mean or anything on a keyboard, but to face to face, they don't know how to deal with people or talk to people. And then I think that would be the best bit of advice, is just try and not get sucked into all that and just go live your best life, go travel, go do whatever you want to do, and put the phone down for a bit if you can.
Okay. And my final question is, what is the meaning of life?
The meaning of life to me is really have resilience and do everything all the time. Like, to me, really, the day does have 24 hours, and I try to dedicate to do everything right at the first time, like with precision and just committed to do something. Like, again, I'm the kind of person that is, oh, I just do things because I really don't like to see myself or think myself. It's like, oh, what would have happened if I would have done this? I just do things. Like, I do really evaluate things very quickly in my head, and I know some of the consequences or whatnot, but I just do the things and just do anything. Just do it, because you're here to do stuff. Whatever it is, just do it right.
Just be.
Yeah.
And Paul, for you, what's the meaning of life?
I think we're, like, before we're born, we're just given this opportunity to live in a world and have all these different experiences. So I think that's, go do everything you can. Have no regrets. Like, just go enjoy life. Do everything that you possibly can. And not have any of these scenarios like, oh, what if I'd done that? Or what if I'd done that? That's it. That's, I think, a lot of people get to retirement and older and have all these things, oh, I wish I'd done that. I think the meaning is just go do everything you can and just live a full life and just have a great time and do whatever you can or whatever it takes, like we've just done. Just do everything that you possibly can. Like, and I think, and just enjoy it, really, and enjoy the ride. Mm-hmm. So.
Paul and Martha, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me telling us your, oh my goodness, it's a hair-raising story about how your little baby got here.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Thank you for hosting, and lovely to talk to you.
Thanks.
The Laura Dowland Experience was brought to you today by Fabi Orandora Lax. Fabi Orandora Lax is my unique blend of botanicals with magnesium and B vitamins. I formulated this blend to reduce stress, calm the nervous system, and to promote a more restful and restorative sleep. Check out the amazing reviews on fabiwellness.com, available on fabiwellness.com and in pharmacies and health food stores nationwide. Thanks for listening.